The Dory Monson Show on Cairo Radio. This is The Big Lead.
Welcome back to The Dory Monson Show. I'm Jack Stein, filling in for Mr. Monson. Where we've been going over all the fallout from I-976 and all the issues that have been coming from that, turned down by the state Supreme Court. Seems like it's a contentious issue. We've had State Senator Steve Oban on. Cairo Radio's own Chris Sullivan helped me kind of understand this more, and now we have Cairo Radio's own Hannah Scott. But before we get to that, producer Nicole, can you just remind our listeners again why this in particular has been such an important issue for the Dory Monson Show? You and Dory have been doing this for quite some time, and could you maybe explain to me why this is so important to the, not only the listeners but also to Dory and to you?
No, not in the short amount of time that we have, but it has been a topic that we've, I feel like we've kind of owned here on the show. And I know that Dory will be happy to talk about it upon return. And I think that, I think it's a bummer that our voices as voters aren't being heard and that they keep being countered by politics and these little things that they find to get rid of these voter voted on initiatives.
Yeah, it is.
So I can't tell you exactly why, although I will tell you, I mean, Dory's line is that Sound Transit is the most corrupt agency in the state. And for sure, he does not want them getting money they should not be getting.
So let's get to the big lead.
The big lead. Top story.
We're speaking now with Cairo Radio's own Hannah Scott. Hannah Scott, I've been learning all afternoon about I-976. I've had a couple people on. We've had a State Senator Steve Oban on. We've had Chris Sullivan on. I'm getting a better idea of what exactly is going on, but I wanted to talk to you about your thoughts about the state Supreme Court striking down the $30 car tab initiative. Could you tell me, you know, just initially when you heard about it, what was going on in your mind?
I was a little bit surprised. The lower court, King County Superior Court, had upheld a good portion of the challenges or of the initiative, kind of shooting down some of these legal challenges. So I thought that it might go the other way, and that the Supreme Court might allow $30 tabs to continue, but not entirely surprised. I think that there are those in our state who think that the court tends to side the way of Seattle, and that we'll see this that way. The bottom line, though, is that they found that this was unconstitutional, violated the state constitution specifically on a couple of issues that, you know, you can kind of see where they're coming from on this. One, of course, is that the ballot title was itself deceptive and misleading by promising to lower car tab taxes except for voter approved charges, while also kind of rolling back taxes that the voters had previously approved. I listened to the oral arguments when the state Supreme Court heard this, and even the justices were confused, and they kind of grilled the attorneys about this. So I think it wasn't necessarily that the writing was clear on the wall, but I think I gave it a 50-50 shot to go either way.
I find it fascinating, as I heard from State Senator Steve Oban. So he said that this went through the process through the AG, that everything had been okayed, and then it comes up as an initiative measure. And then now, only after it passes, now we see problems with the phrasing and the wording. I'm looking at it that said disputing the ballot language is, quote, misleading to voters. That's what a judge in King County Superior Court issued a temporary injunction back in November. And it seems like now, finally, in October of 2020, it's now gone. And I think to myself, what a tremendous, this is just my initial response to this, Hannah Scott, is that what a tremendous waste of time and energy and resources, my initial thought. But then as it turns out that there are, as I'm learning today, that there are people who are saying, no, that this is how the process should take place. And do you see any holes in this process, or do you consider it to be, well, you know, this is just the way things go in Washington State?
No, and I think that there are definitely holes in this process. I think the problem is, and the way the current process is, this is how it should play out. Absolutely. It went through all the proper channels up, you know, the constitutionality question would lie with the state Supreme Court. Where there needs to be a fix, I think, and I think there are a lot of people on both sides of the issue who would agree with this, is we need to have ballot initiative reform to begin with. Because the fact that these ballot titles, and it comes down to this almost every time there's a legal challenge, that the ballot titles, which are limited to 30 words, have to be very specifically worded, or you can face these types of legal challenges, and then it takes months and months and months, and they end up going all the way to the state Supreme Court. And it's a tremendous waste of time and resources, and it's frustrating to the voters, because now what you have in this situation, half the voters feel like their vote didn't count. And that's going to be something that's a really big concern for not just the voters, but also for our elected leaders in the state who are frustrated with that. But if you can fix kind of the way our initiative process works, so where there really has to be a very specific clarity in the ballot title, and also where you can say, look, this is what's going to happen. Here's going to be the fiscal impact if you vote for this, and here's what it's going to be if you don't vote for this. And it's just kind of laid out clearly, though, there from the get-go, then we don't end up with these kind of legal challenges, and it's kind of straightforward. So I think that there's going to be a big push for some legislation that might do that. Not sure how that will fare, though, as far as getting passed.
So you're telling me that in order to get an initiative measure, the title of it has to be 30 words or less? Is that the...
Yes.
It has to... Okay, so let me just give you my initial impression of that. That sounds like madness, that I have to, for a third of a tweet, I have to do, the title has to be that length, mandatory, across the board. I don't know why anybody looked at that. Like, if someone came up to me and said, hey, you know, the title of your paper in college, they said the title of your paper can only be 5 words long, I would say, what does it matter if it's 5 words or 50 words, as long as it's coherent and cogent? That just seems so arbitrary and almost draconian in some weird way, that we would only be able to have 30 words in the title. Otherwise, it's got to go back for review, and we have to go through this huge process. I am just blown away by that, Hannah Scott. I would agree with you that kind of that needs to change. It seems like that's so silly in so many ways.
And
30
and
words.
Yes, in 30 words. And what the wording is, it has to be very specific. And you'll see legal challenges oftentimes before people even vote on these initiatives. They end up before the state Supreme Court because of they're arguing about what the ballot title can be. It's an absolutely bizarre process that I've not seen any other state that I've lived in, having come from California. So I think that there's definitely room for improvement. And the straight up question is, how can it now be, if it's essentially found unconstitutional, how did we not catch this somewhere earlier in the process, right? That what was in the ballot title wasn't going to work. And there's no answer to that. So that's something that needs to be addressed.
Someone's heads are going to roll, Hannah Scott. Heads are going to roll over this. At least the way it works in California, I actually just got my ballot in California. They send you it's like a single document, and they do very truncated versions, and then they say, are you for it or against it? And then you fill in the little bubble. And the wording, for the most part, is pretty clear. Sometimes it's a little deceptive, but I don't find, nor do I hear people kind of going back and forth about how many words and in what order and what structure. And if I wanted to junk up the wheels of a system, if I wanted to slow down a system, that's what I would do. I would put in these kind of like 1984 rules where that has to be a certain length and it has to be a certain wording, and then we argue about the semantics of the wording. By the way, I'm Jack Stein. I'm filling in for Mr. Dory Monson today, where we're speaking with Cairo Radio's own Hannah Scott. We're talking about Initiative 976, which I am told is Mr. Dory Monson's baby, and so it's my pleasure to be able to try to understand this and try to get a grasp of it, because the more I've learned about this, Hannah Scott, the more information that gets put into my brain over the course of the show, the more frustrated I get with just not only the process, but people's response to this. And if I was against it, let's say I was against 976, I would still be thinking to myself, what exactly is going on with our process where we take a year of everybody's time over wording? That would not that we would go through the process of adjudicating it and hashing it out in that way, but over wording. Seems like, you know, it's kind of, in a weird way, kind of taking away the vote from the 53% of people who did, you know, vote for this thing.
Sure, and there's definitely that sense. Look, in reading the Supreme Court decision at this on this particular issue, the ballot title, they referenced things like where the semicolon was and that how it needs to be put together grammatically. And there were other issues, but when you're getting down to stuff like that, the voters are going, wait, what? The other issue, though, that I want to make sure we touch on is that it was also found unconstitutional because it violated the state's single subject rule. And then you get kind of into the weeds on this. But in our state, under the Constitution, a ballot initiative is only allowed to address one issue or multiple issues that address the same, you know, kind of overwhelming umbrella issue. And in this case, that wasn't found to be the case because overwhelmingly it was supposed to be about repealing various vehicle taxes and fees, but also in there as part of the Sound Transit, that's our transit system, they have bonding out against kind of, it's what led to the high car tabs in the first place. So there's a bonding issue for this expansion of light rail that ties into this and is kind of the whole reason we went for $30 car tabs. They said the fact that it requires those bonds to be defeased or paid off early was not related to the initial subject of vehicle taxes and fees. So therefore, it was found unconstitutional. That also seems like it should have been a pretty easy, you know, understandable thing before people ended up voting on this. So again, we're back to how do you even let this go to the voters in the first place when it's not? Why can't we decide this before it goes to the voters?
I was doing Cairo Nights a couple weeks ago, and the issue of car tabs came up. Someone comes in on the text line and they say, I pay $300 in car tab fees. And I thought, how could that possibly be a thing for somebody? How could that possibly, that amount of money over this? And it kind of makes me think of, if I wanted to, let's say I had taxed everybody to death already, and I had already gone through everything that I possibly could to try to, you know, get tax on the property taxes. I know you guys don't have income taxes in Washington.
Right.
But if I wanted to continue to get more money from people, what's the easiest way to do it? Well, I go after cars, and then I force people to have to not force, but I encourage people to take public transit, so on and so forth. I was looking at the money Hannah Scott seems like this potentially could have taken away $4 billion from the transit system and upwards of like $20 billion over a certain amount of time. How important is the public transit system to Seattle as a whole or to Washington as a whole?
It's very, very important to the Puget Sound region as a whole, for sure. So that's your King County, the Seattle area, to the north and the Everett right. area, and then south over in Tacoma, Pierce County area, for sure. But there's people who have been, you know, there are people who have been paying taxes for light rail that's not even here yet. And there's been delays from the Sound Transit Agency, and it's over budget often. And so there's a big sense of distrust. This is a very partisan issue also in the state. So you'll have folks like Republican Senator Steve O'Bannon, who has been, you know, really leading the fight against Sound Transit over things like being over budget, misleading voters, he would say, at the ST3 thing that was approved by expansion that was approved by voters back in 2015, that is what ultimately led to these high car tab fees. He would say that they were misleading voters with their own ballot title and all of that. There was a whole big fight leading up to that. So yeah. It goes round and round. But the transit is definitely exceptionally important to a certain population here in the Puget Sound region. I'd say the majority of folks here definitely believe it's a necessity and we need to expand, but not everyone believes that way. So, for instance, on that ST3 vote, the vote to expand the light rail system, which was just in the Sound Transit's voting district, which is basically Puget Sound and a few kind of outlying communities, they voted to approve that tax, right? Now, that tax led to the higher car tabs, so it was the people statewide who voted to undo that tax, if you can follow me along. So there's half the state who doesn't want it and half the voters who do. And so now both sides feel that they got left out with their vote not counting.
Yeah. And it just seems as if people now were saying to themselves, as Steve O'Bannon pointed out previously, at what point do voters feel like their vote no longer matters on either side of the argument, right? At which point
Sure.
do you get so disenfranchised that you say, well, we went through the process and we either won fair and square, we lost fair and square, and now this system, I hate to use the word bureaucrats, but we have this system
Yeah.
that comes in and says, well, your vote doesn't matter anymore. Your vote, remember that thing that is so precious to you as a citizen of these fine United States and as of the fine state of Washington? Now that doesn't matter. And I would caution people who kind of celebrate this as a win to maybe think about that this could be coming for something that you really wanted next. This could be coming down the line for you next. So I agree with you, Hannah Scott, when you say that the process needs to be altered in some way, or at least needs to be tightened up in some way. Do you have any thoughts or recommendations as to how that process could be tightened up?
Certainly. I think that we absolutely need to find a way to change the initiative process to make sure that we know what we're sending to people to vote on, that we know ahead of time that it's going to pass the legal muster, right? So that it doesn't end up being challenged in court because it didn't have a semicolon in the wrong, you know, in the right place in the ballot title, or that it already violated the single subject rule. How can you not know that before right. you send it to people to vote on? That shouldn't take this long to figure out. So I think there's a push. You'll see a push in the legislative session where they'll be trying to pass something that will reform that. I don't think it's the first time that that push will happen. And who knows if it gets passed with all of the other things going on at this point. But there's definitely people pushing for that to happen. The other thing is, too, that I want to mention is there are a lot of people in the state from around the state who think that Seattle governs Washington. So whatever Seattle wants, so Seattle needs the transportation for sure that came with the Sound Transit District and all of that. So they are on that very partisan side going to say, we don't want to be ruled the way Seattle does. So this really divides the state. But one of the things that this initiative would have done was repeal some separate voter-approved taxes and fees on vehicles. So several dozens of different cities and municipalities have these where it's an extra $20 on your car tab fee that you pay in Seattle, let's say, or $80, and it goes towards maintaining roads and various other things, or bus service and things like that. So there was such a wide-ranging outcome of what would have been cut had this been able to stay in place. It's way more than just $30 car tabs.
Hannah Scott, thank you so much for illuminating this issue for me. I feel like I'm an expert in it at this point in the show.
I know, it's a lot of information.
It's a lot. It's a tremendous amount, and I appreciate it very much. You're listening to the Dory Monson Show. I'm Jack Stein. I'm filling in for Mr. Dory Monson. Hannah Scott, thank you again so much for your time. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back after this. Show. I'm Jack Stein. I'm filling in for Mr. Dory Monson. I just wanted to touch on this story really quick, that breaking story about a Seattle police car set on fire with officers inside. I hope that those officers are okay. I'm looking at a picture of it, and if you see that this picture from King 5, but if you look at this picture, that car went up, and it went up fast. And still a breaking story. I sincerely hope they find the individual who committed that crime. Because at that point, that's murder, right? Or at least attempted murder. And I don't know what goes through the mind of someone like that, where they see a couple of police officers sitting in a car and they think, well, I'm going to get my vengeance. I'm going to get my retribution. I do know how someone gets to that point. I do know that at least when I was in college, it doesn't matter what classroom you go to. It could be math. It could be social sciences. It could be anthropology. It could be political theory, which is what one of my degrees is in. Anywhere you go, frequently, there is this kind of anti-authority sentiment, and it bleeds over. It's not just, you know, president's bad, government's bad. It bleeds over into police officers, and it bleeds over into firemen. And that if you charge these young people up, to the point over the course of like 4 years, if you charge all these kids up believing that the system that they live in is horrible and that everybody's constantly out to get them and the police is their enemy, then you release them into the world. What are they supposed to do with all that fear and all that angst and all that violence that's within them? Like if you were to say to somebody, hey, you know, sometimes the police do pretty awful things. Sometimes certain circumstances come up. A police officer can do a pretty horrible and awful and terrible thing. But that doesn't mean that all cops are bad. All police officers are bad. If you tried to have that conversation with somebody, normally people would get that. They'd get that level. Yeah, you know, sometimes cops do something. I don't like it. if it's a crime, then they should be prosecuted for it, and we move on with our lives. But that lingering anger is something that I never have been able to fully understand. To the point where you're going to take a Molotov cocktail or whatever this person tried to do, and actually, I don't want to say too much about it now because it's just breaking. But if they were in the car and you throw something in a car and that thing is on fire, I would say that you're probably trying to take somebody's life. And that is just completely unacceptable. Speaking of unacceptable, I was just going through a couple of posts, and I found that this article from Jerusalem Post, it said over 70% of coronavirus patients wore masks, followed guidelines. So again, 70% of people who contracted coronavirus, according to this study, wore a mask and followed guidelines. That kind of throws a monkey in the wrench of the theory behind masks. Now, I'm a mask guy. I'm a mask guy and a social distance guy and a wash your hands guy because I have people in my life who I love and care for, and I don't want them to get COVID-19. My very good friend Billy Sunshine is morbidly obese. He's 72 years old. He eats nothing but Milano cookies and pizza all day. He is the kind of person who he walks out his front door and COVID-19 just starts licking its lips. He's the kind of person that COVID-19 would love to infect. And because I love and I care for him so much, I do all of these things because I do come in contact with him. And I don't want him to get the disease. But this is saying that maybe this whole mandate thing. I know people were talking about back when Joe Biden was asked about masks. He said, I would make it a national mandate. Well, according to this study, face masks and covering are not 100% effective at preventing the spread of coronavirus. From back in September, the study found that 70% of the 154 case patients who had tested positive for COVID-19 were infected despite making efforts to abide by CDC guidelines. Wow. I mean, that's tremendous. Again, you say 154 people, 70% of that could be a fluke study. I don't actually think so, though, because we keep hearing about people who are coming down with coronavirus despite their best efforts. And this goes back to my original thesis about this whole thing. Is that most people are probably going to get COVID-19. Before a vaccine comes out, you're probably going to get it. If you're under a certain age, probably not going to affect you very much at all. If you take care of yourself at an older age, probably not going to affect you very much at all. I'm actually surprised, when President Trump came down with COVID-19, I actually thought the worst. Admittedly, I thought the worst. And then it hit me. Oh, wait, it's been 6 months. We've got all these therapeutics. We've got all these different treatments for it. I think he'll be okay. And he was. And look at him. He's bouncing back now. He's totally fine. So I wonder if the fear around COVID-19, if we're still living with February, March, April fear, if that makes sense. It's like we're still stuck back there. When in reality, there's been so many advances around COVID-19 that maybe we shouldn't have that same level of fear. In fact, I don't think that we should, particularly when the New York Times released an article earlier this summer said that 40% of all coronavirus patients, elderly people in nursing homes. Wow. Wow. Wow, I say to myself. So are we doing this thing now where because it was initially so scary, February, March, April, we didn't know what it was. There weren't any treatments for it. People were getting put on ventilators. And then now we're at a point where we go, well, we have all these treatments and we have all these systems in place to help people recover from the disease. Maybe we should be doing this thing where we go back and we open up businesses and we allow people to go about their normal lives instead of doing this thing where we're living in fear from 6 months ago. If you think about it, it is a miracle of modern science and, dare I say, American ingenuity that the amount of therapeutics and treatment options have come out so quickly. 6 to 7 months, I would say, it took for us to get to this point. Where someone, for example, like Donald Trump, who's a little bit overweight, doesn't eat so good, doesn't really exercise that much, he's able to come out of it in what? What was that? 3 days, maybe? 4 days? So living with this fear. Again, just to remind people, I'm Jack Stein. I'm filling in for Dory Monson if you're just tuning in. I'm not sure if living in this fear world is the best anymore. I personally, as a young man, I'm 33 years old. When I go out and I look at my people who are my age and they're walking around outdoors with a mask on and they're 6 feet away from me, I go, okay, but I don't really think that we need to do that. In fact, there was an article that came out 2 days ago from CNN where they did a study, certain group, a KTTF group, did this study of mental health issues coming up during COVID-19. They found that something like 53% increase in mental health issues being reported to hospitals, social workers, therapists, based on isolation costs from COVID-19. So now we're actually hurting people. Now we're actually getting to the point where trying to keep everybody safe, trying to do the right thing, is actually hurting people. Businesses are shutting down. People can't go to school. People can't see their friends. People can't see their family because they're scared. And now people are becoming more and more depressed, and they're becoming more and more saddened by this whole thing. When you take away someone's agency, when you take away someone's ability to move around in the world, yeah, they're going to get really depressed. I mean, you think about it. You put an animal in a cage for too long. What's going to happen? Like, you ever see monkeys at a zoo back in the 1960s? Pretty unhappy. You ever leave your dog in a kennel during a road trip? Pretty unhappy. Human beings are very much the same way. So when you take away the ability for people to even go to a park, or even when you say, well, you can't see anybody. If you go to a restaurant, you can only go with the people who live in your own home. When you take that away from people, yeah, there's going to be all these ramifications. So again, this study is saying that, hey, maybe masks aren't the thing that we need to be focusing on right now. Maybe the thing that we need to be focusing on is doing the best that we can to make sure that we don't get it, don't spread it around, wash our hands, wear masks, social distance, wait for a vaccine. That's the best you can do. But shutting everything down, locking everything down, what Jay Inslee was talking about a couple of weeks ago, talking about, oh, we'll have the bars open at 11 as opposed to 10, all these little arbitrary rules. Hair salons can't open, all these little tiny arbitrary, trying to micromanage it. When has that ever worked previously? It certainly isn't working now, I'll tell you that much. I am Jack Stein. I am filling in for Mr. Dory Monson. We got to take a quick break. When we get back, we're going to go to the audio clip of the day with producer Nicole. If you want to check out my YouTube channel, Human Genius, two words, pretty easy to find. I do the same thing there that I do here, but there's fun visuals, and you get to see my handsome face. Once again, Human Genius. Going to take a quick break. We'll be right back after this. Welcome back to the Dory Monson Show. I'm Jack Stein. It's been a pleasure to be here for the last 3 hours. It's been very educational. Nicole Thompson, I feel like I've learned a lot about Initiative I-976. I feel like I've learned
a lot about it. There's a lot to learn on that one, and I don't think we've seen the end of it. I think we'll keep learning more.
Nicole, apparently trick-or-treating is banned. Did you hear about this? This is like madness.
Well, I mean, there's slowly been cancellations of community trick-or-treating and different Halloween events. In the city I live in, you normally have the businesses all come out to the sidewalk on the main street and set up little tables and just hand out treats to the kids, and that even was banned. So yeah, it's slowly been getting banned, but I do know the story you're going to talk about where the city has actually said it's not allowed.
We can all thank the fine city of Beverly Hills for being heroes to the Republic and banning trick-or-treating for Halloween 2020. Let's just all give them a good thank you very much for ruining children's lives yet again. We appreciate it. I don't understand what the justification is behind this. I know that if I'm outdoors and I'm walking around, I don't even necessarily even have to go up to somebody's house when I'm trick-or-treating, right? They could develop some kind of COVID-safe system. This is the thing about Americans in particular. We think stuff out. Like, we know how to get around stuff. So we saw that during the lockdowns in Los Angeles when everybody said, you can't go to the beach anymore. And what did everybody do? They went down to Orange County to go to the beach. So we figure this stuff out. I just think that I don't know what they're going for other than to try to remind everybody that they're in total control of everyone's lives at all time. Like, yeah, you can't just, take your kids out.
Can't do that. Chuck a piece of candy at a kid.
Get a slingshot, shoot it right into the bag.
I've seen some fun stuff going around.
What is the audio clip of the day? What's the favorite audio clip?
Well, so the way that we do this actually is we have three clips. It's kind of like a countdown thing. Some days there's not as many depending on the time. But first we have to call for the big lead sounder. So, Sean, let's get to the big lead.
This is Dory Monson's awesome audio clips of the day.
I said big lead. Awesome audio. Whoops. So the first cut, we didn't get to this in the last segment, but it goes along with that CDC director saying that masks were, or 80% of the people infected by COVID were not wearing masks, I guess. And so Tucker Carlson did that story, and then the CDC contacted him, said he was misleading, and this is his response to that.
A spokesman for the CDC said that our coverage was misleading. Now, the spokesman didn't dispute that we had showed accurate data from the CDC, including that 85% of people who tested positive for coronavirus in July reported wearing a mask always or often. Instead, the spokesman said this, quote, at no time has CDC guidance suggested that masks were intended to protect the wearers. Huh? At no time has the CDC suggested that masks were intended to protect people who wear masks. That's what they said tonight. Now, that would be news to the director of the CDC, Robert Redfield. Here he was last month.
I might even go so far as to say that this face mask is more guaranteed to protect me against COVID than when I take a COVID vaccine.
This is the CDC? They're protecting us from this pandemic? They don't even know what their own director is saying. But whatever you do, don't question public health experts. Facebook and Twitter and Google will shut you down. Just put your mask on and obey.
Yeah, Tucker gets it from all sides, man. Even when he tries,
right?
even when he tries to say, hey, listen, there's more data out there. Here's the problem with COVID-19 in general, just as a theme, as a topic. You come into any conversation with somebody and you say to them, hey, you know, there's all this data that's come out about how it mostly affects older people. And, you know, maybe social distancing is good. Washing your hands is good. But maybe we don't need to do this whole lockdown thing. And then that person explodes and they go, this is your fault. You're spreading the virus. You're responsible. So it puts you in the position of not even wanting to talk about new information that comes out. If you watch any mainstream media stream right now, you go to ABC, CNN, it's so macabre. They have a ticker tape of the amount of people who have passed away on the side of the screen. And so you want me to do that? Or you want me to be an independent thinker who can go and read on my own? You want me just to sit around all day and watch a ticker tape? Or do you want me to actually go out and read? So I can empathize with Tucker getting it. It's absurd to me, the lack of nuance that people have around COVID-19. For even someone like me who says, yeah, wear a mask. Yeah, just go ahead and do it. People go, how dare you? You're spreading COVID-19. So what's the next clip?
Well, we're running a little short on time, so I'm going to skip to number one, which we didn't get to this. We also did the story about the women waiting in line to drop off clothes at Goodwill to donate, and some angry men came up beside them. I guess were mad about them blocking the roadway or something along those lines, and they ended up getting pepper sprayed. So here's Cairo 7 talking to Emily and her friend Melissa.
And they were like, upset that we were stopped, so they zoomed around us and screeched their tires, flipped us off, and we were like, that was super aggressive.
They quickly returned with a weapon.
They came back within a minute.
But this time they slowed down and shot pepper spray into my car. They hit, blinded me, got in like my nose, my mouth, my ear. There was like spray marks literally probably from here all the way here.
Emily's like, oh my God, my eyes. And then like she jumps out of the car and then Luna jumps out of the car and Luna's like pawing her eye.
I feel
Luna
bad for those young
dog. Yeah. Who also got sprayed.
I feel bad
sprayed.
For those young ladies. That's just such a sad story. I hope they catch that guy. I hope they catch the person
they ended
who
up-
did that.
I have a couple more. They ended up going to the hospital.
Got in my eyes, so I couldn't see. I couldn't breathe. It was in my mouth.
And like I said, they assume that this is somebody nearby bad about the roadblock.
That was my first reaction. Was like, is that a gun? And I was like, that's a squirt gun. It's like green.
Based on the like level of aggression from them knowing that we were in the Goodwill line, I'm assuming that kind of animosity probably comes from a local who lives in the area and deals with something like that often.
And it was a white
Denali. I'm Jack Stein. I've been filling in for Mr. Dory Monson. Got to get out of here. Thanks so much, Nicole. Really do appreciate you producing the whole show. And I will be back tomorrow. Once again, I'm Jack Stein filling in for Mr. Dory Monson. See you tomorrow.
Sometimes patience is the key to victory. Sometimes it leads to very little. And it seems like it's not worth it. And you wonder why you waited so long for something so disappointing.
Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. You're really a fantastic audience.